Hey, live on the gang today, we've got three big topics we're going to cover. One is about what is the end goal of DevOps here? Should it have an end goal? Second, we're going to talk about anti-patterns in DevSecOps. And then third, we're going to have a deep philosophical discussion about what's best for society. Working from home, working in the office, some combination, who knows? We've got that and more live today on the Tech Strong Gang. Hi, good morning, everyone. Alan Schimmel here for Tech Strong Group on the Tech Strong Gang. I'm joined by our usual gang members and a very special guest who's a longtime Tech Strong family friend member. But first, let me introduce our chief content officer sitting here to my left or right, depending on if this is mirrored or not, Mike Vizard. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yep. Joining Mike and I, we're at Tech Strong headquarters, joining us from their abodes on the road, and who says we don't allow remote working, is our CTO and chief research analyst at Tech Strong Research, Mitchell Ashley. Mitchell, welcome.
Good morning. Great to be here. Welcome, everybody.
Yep. And then joining us from Texas, our managing editor for TechStrong AI and DigitalCXO.com, Amanda Rossini. Hi, Amanda. How are you? Good. Amanda, just check you're not on mute. And then our very special guest, TechStrong Gang member, making his debut on TechStrong Gang, but he's been writing on DevOps.com and been part of the family here for probably nine years now. The one and only Bob Resselman joining us very early in the morning out in L.A. Hey, Bob, it's great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks. Good morning.
good morning. Yeah. All right. So I said in the preamble, we got three main blocks we want to hit on today. Mike, do you want to kick it off?
I do, because it's going to be a very philosophical show from start to finish. So Don McVitie has a great piece up on DevOps.com talking about, well, what are the implications of AI for our fellow DevOps professionals? Because the goal has always been to, quote unquote, ruthlessly automate. But if we automate to the point now where are we pushing ourselves out of existence here? Who will do what? Because as he points out, if the machines are writing all the code, well, then what do we need all the folks for to manage this process? Because the whole thing will become highly automated. I know this is top of mind for you as of late, but lots of DevOps folks are wanting to know, where's my cheese going?
So first of all, I would say that automation has not always been the chief goal of DevOps. I think the chief goal of DevOps has been to break down silos and cultural among people, not process, not tools, among people, so that they work better together. And in working better together, we can have higher quality and go faster. If higher quality going faster entails automation, that's good too. But don't underestimate the power of people and of culture in DevOps. But I think we're mischaracterizing Don's article in all due respect. I think the point of Don's article is, what is the end goal for DevOps, right? Because if the initial goal was to make people work together better, break down silos, okay, we've achieved some modicum of success in that, right? We've added automation to the mix. We've done a lot of that. Platform engineering, check. SRE, check. You know, DevOps seems to be this ever-growing amoeba umbrella that encompasses many things. When is it finished? What does success look like? When can we shut the oven off? And AI is just the latest check on this whole DevOps, when's it done? And it promises in many ways, as you said, Mike, to be the most impactful. But I think the point of Don's article is you have business people, right? The business team, Dev Biz Ops, who's ruthlessly moving forward. Let's do more, faster, better, cheaper, right? Automate, what have you. And then you have an IT team who says, you know, I'm just following orders here. Tell me what your priorities are and we'll make it happen. I don't think the world's that clean cut. The other thing is, look, DevOps never had a definition. It never had a manifesto. It was always amorphous by design. Why should that stop now? I'll leave it right there.
All right. Mr. Wrestleman, since you are new to our show and a guest, do you want to weigh in here? Because you are, after all, one of the more deeper thinkers in the land of IT.
Deeper thinker. There's another T-shirt. Well, let's remember the days before DevOps. I was actually working production at that time, and everybody get together, and we'd have a major deployment, and we'd all sit in a war room, and they'd put in, you know, the potato chips and the soda and the ice cream and coffee and all that stuff, and there would be the zip files. We'd be passing zip files between servers all over the place. That's what it was like, and then everything would go wrong, and then people be there for the weekend and get really mad and do all that stuff. And one day, somebody woke up and said, you know, there has to be a better way. There just has to be a better way because we can't afford it. And my thinking is that the foundation of DevOps was financial efficiency. We just can't afford to keep doing this. And when we looked at it, we said, okay, well, what's one of the big problems we have? Well, we have developers in one pot making the zip files, and we have ops in the other part deploying the zip files, right? And that's just not working. And maybe if we got them together, that would work out. That's the good news. The bad news is that people can only identify that which we know what to look for. So what do I mean? If you've never seen a giraffe, how can you go looking for a giraffe, right? And the reason I'm saying this is that what's happened in DevOps, it's almost become somewhat analogous to systems administration. When we start looking at what people are saying, well, you know, systems, you know, make the machines do system administration, the spirit of being able to, as Alan pointed out, of being able to talk to one another and being able to do away with this whole insanity of developers giving stuff to systems admins and making sure it gets out the door goes away. So what's the end game? There is no end game. I mean, that's what people want, their software, and they want their software as fast as possible. So there you have it.
I don't know. I'm going to weigh in on that too. Yeah. No, you got my punchline too, which is, I don't think it's a sensical question. It's like, what's the end game of waterfall or agile or weather? There isn't an end game. It's about adapting this approach to what's important in your business, right? If we are like in dire straits for getting software out because we really suck at it, and it takes 9 months to get a release out, which is kind of the days Bob was talking about, which mean back in those days too, by the way, you had your backout plan because about half the time you had to back it all out and go re-upgrade again. But it's about, you know, what's important to the business, right? Do we want to implement AI? Well, that doesn't mean no DevOps or DevOps. It means that's just a way of doing software. So to me, it's not, I understand there are business goals and measurements for success. Those are all great. That's not an end goal.
I will argue something. Oh, go ahead, sir.
Oh, well, I just want to jump in on what Bob said about the deep thinkers and also what you just said, Mitch. So what spoke to me most in that article was if there was some sort of end goal and the end goal was use AI to automate everything and remove IT roles, then the question is going to be, where are the deep thinkers, the philosophers that question situations that could come up in the future or problems that don't exist yet? If there's nobody writing code and there's nobody able to do those things, then AI is going to come to a point where it can't solve issues in the future. And that would be concerning. So that was interesting and made me think that we need to keep the human element, the philosophers, and the deep thinking about the future.
I would argue there is indeed a goal. And I'm going to disagree with you. And the goal is to make this stuff as transparent as possible. I think we had John Willis on the show. He's a big fan of Turing, I think it is, who said...
Deming,
who I think said something to the degree that any process that you can see is broken. It's pretty clear to me that we see DevOps all the time and there's tons of bottlenecks, so therefore it is broken. AI may move it along from where it is today, but I think the ultimate goal is to make it so transparent as that you don't see it, you don't experience, doesn't mean it goes away. But today, there's too much noise in the system that results in rollbacks, to Mitch's point, or results in vulnerabilities that aren't addressed. I think we got a long way to go here, and maybe AI is a step in the direction.
I got to call BS on you, man.
All right.
Because I'm going to tell you something.
If you don't, I will.
Exactly. And Mitch is ready to jump through the screen because, guys, I got to tell you, we have less rollbacks today than we ever did. That's for damn sure, right? Before DevOps, you know, upgrading to a new version was hit or miss at best.
You know, that 12-inch stick in my eye is so much worse than the 6-inch stick in my eye, so it doesn't really matter.
Okay. And then, secondly, not just the rollbacks, but vulnerabilities. Shit, excuse my language. God, at least we scan for vulnerabilities before we deploy code now, and that's actually part of the process. We never did that.
I wish we did scan, but it's pretty clear from every article that we write on Security Boulevard that we are not scanning.
No, we are scanning.
There is an article today, in fact, from Phylum did their research, showed that hardly anybody scans any of the packages they download from the JavaScript files. And so it's just kind of
so you're talking about SCA, right? Software code analysis is those things. So we scan more those than we ever did before. Now, can we be better? Yes. But let's be clear. Software coming out of the chute today is many, many times more secure than when Mitchell and I and Bob were referencing, sitting around with the potato chips and ice cream, unzipping zip files. Oh, and we had to get it done, and I got my kid's birthday this weekend. I can't be here all weekend. Screw the scanning, I'll do it later. We've automated scanning. Could scanning be better? Could scanning find more vulnerabilities? Yeah, yes, and it is, it's getting better. But make no mistake, you know, it's very easy to put the rose-colored glasses on and wax nostalgic about the old days. The old days weren't the good old days.
Hardly at all. I don't think anybody's saying that. I'm
arguing that we've made tremendous progress.
You were describing the Stanley Steemer age of software development, and the rest of us are going, where's my flying car?
So. Exactly.
I did read that article, and I was a little surprised at the vast percentage of incidents they did find. I think it was like 47% of malicious code in the software, which seems kind of high to me.
So, Mitch, what do you say?
Well, sorry, not to gloss over what you said, Amanda, because I'm thinking about that. I go back and reread that part of the article. I think... So I'm just going to pick on you a little bit, not as much as Alan did, Mike. The flaw in what you said was DevOps is not a process, right? It's a method. It's an approach to developing software. So it can't be invisible because you're continuously improving all different aspects of it. And that's why rise of DevSecOps and platform image, all these different things come about, or you can localize it just about CI/CD, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit. So that's my argument about it shouldn't be invisible. It should have low friction, and it should facilitate getting software out, the right software out the door at the right time.
But Bob.
Oh, and yet we have the corporate paradox of the title called the DevOps engineer. If DevOps is a way of life, then what does a DevOps engineer do? Engineer my life, right? But there are people out there lined up around the corner trying to hire DevOps engineers, right? So that's just sort of strange to me, which is, again, going back to my argument that this notion of DevOps can only be interpreted in the language you have, which is, if I'm a system admin, guess what? DevOps is systems administration. Right. Or if I'm not so much a system admin, if I'm a corporation or a CFO more likely, I can only imagine my organization to have system administrators, people that run, you know, turn the dials, people that, you know, tighten the bolts. And for that, I need an engineer. I need a DevOps engineer, which, you know, meet the old sysadmin, the new sysadmins, the DevOps engineer.
He makes more money, though. But Bob, he makes more money as a DevOps engineer.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Or he's going to make a lot more money being a platform engineer.
Engineer, exactly. Yeah, but let's talk about bottlenecks for a second, right? You know, again, I'll go back to Phoenix Project, which is based on the goal, right? The very nature of business in the goal that was manufacturing in Phoenix Project, it's software manufacturing, is... there's always bottlenecks. You're never going to be done with bottlenecks. You're never going to reach nirvana. by definition, it's almost unknowable and reachable. You can know, you know, it's like knowing God. You can't really know, it's something on faith. You don't know the essence of the deity. But the very nature of this process is as soon as you solve one bottleneck, it now gives you vision into the next bottleneck and so on and so on. And you, and to a certain extent, that's the way of DevOps, the same way it was the way in the goal, is trying to get to those bottlenecks and solve them as quickly as possible so we can get to the next one. And that's the whole, right, to Don's, full circle, to Don's article, if the goal is to remove bottlenecks, you're never going to reach your goal. And maybe DevOps was set up that way to begin with, never to have an end goal. Have we exhausted this?
We have not.
Okay, Mike's ready to go.
I'm going to come back on it and say DevOps is a means to an end. It is not the end in itself, and therefore, what is the end? And the end is to make the business more efficient, more mm-hmm. effective. I would argue the DevOps tail is wagging the business dog because now the business is having a hard time keeping up with the pace of change from DevOps. There's still work to be done on the DevOps yeah. side, but the business side of the house is sitting there going, I'm not sure we can absorb that frequency of updates and changes. We see it in the digital transformation conversation all the time. But DevOps itself is not the goal. It is something else.
It empowers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm talked out on it. Mitch, Amanda, yeah. Bob, anything else?
I'll throw one more thing in, is that I think what's changed with DevOps is that the frequency of change is much greater, but the degree of change is much smaller. You know, the days of Bob and I sitting in the conference room, you know, why didn't the implementation, what happened with the install or the database conversion script? You know, those days are over. So we all live in this world where our software's in constant change. How often does Zoom and Chrome and everything else we use update itself every day? Now, getting an enterprise system to working in that kind of fashion is no small feat, but I think the change can be smaller, Mike, than what the business is used to saying. I just changed our process to match the new version of the software. Don't change it again. That's kind of the old days, at least to me it is.
Fair enough. All right. You know what? Let's take a quick break. And by the way, excellent article by our friend Don McVitie. But let's take a quick break. We'll be back here in a second with more Tech Strong Gang.
All right, folks, welcome back. We are now going to talk about our second favorite, most contentious philosophical topic, DevSecOps. Our friends at TechStrong Research have a new report out about anti-patterns as it applies to CICD and security, and I'm going to let Mitch explain what's in there, but it seems like to me, just to get the argument started, you know, we're saying you should take your vitamins, but I don't know. What's in there, Mitch?
Yeah, every day, but you know, we don't always do that, right? Well, so what this was about is a collaboration with Red Hat, looking at supply chain security, software supply chain security, and thinking about the DevOps pipeline in particular around the CI/CD process. But you can think about it more broadly than that. And the definition of an anti-pattern, at least for the purposes of this report, is a pattern or practice that kind of gives you a false sense of security. Like, doing these things, I'm good. I don't have to do more. That's fine. I'm secure. So scanning images that I put into my software supply chain, getting them from a reliable source, scanning for vulnerabilities, those are all good things. Nothing wrong with that. But is that enough? If it was enough, we wouldn't have supply chain attacks. So we talked to people about what are they doing to secure the inside of the workflow pipeline, the DevOps tool chain, and how software and work flows through that. And sort of one of the interesting conclusions was one approach that's being used is using kind of a cloud native, some aspects of it, where you containerize and compartmentalize different parts of the CI/CD process of the supply chain and secure it at a more granular level. And people were using kind of that approach, borrowing some ideas from cloud native and, things we've had before cloud native. But that was really interesting to me, and how many people were either considering or doing that. The other is, you know, there were a substantial number of people that were reported they'd had some kind of a breach or some security incident in their supply chain, in their own software development process. So pretty fascinating work, I thought. It's great to work on it.
Bob, what's your take on this? And I'm going to ask you this question in this context. We hear the phrase shift left all the time. So who should be in charge of this security? Because some people would say, pardon my French, that shift left equals shit left. And people are complaining about that. The developers are saying, I can't handle the cognitive load. I can barely do what I'm currently doing. So where does this DevSecOps security function belong in your mind?
It's a good question, because this is, you know, one aspect of it. This is about securing how the pipeline of where we create software versus the security of the software we're creating in that, that flows through that pipeline, if that makes sense. And it's pretty clear that, you know, Bob was talking about, you know, the sysadmin, you know, new boss, the same as the old boss, right? The DevOps engineers doing this work. Those are the people who really probably going to have to do most of this heavy lifting, because the security engineer is going to go in and configure Jenkins and configure, put it into containers and do all those things, right? Maybe some platform engineering might help if they need that. But it's really a system administration function for the development tool chain. So I think in that aspect, it lives more in the people who support the underlying tools and how they integrate and how they're secured in a software development process. Bob, I appreciate your perspective on this.
Well,
and feel free to disagree if you don't think
this is a good thing or not. For you, Mitch. Yeah. When in your research, were the companies looking at the artifacts, or were they looking at the artifact deployment process? I'm asking you that. Was it more, okay, we're just going to take the code, we're going to scan the artifact, we're going to send it out, or were they actually looking at the process of which inspection happened? That's my question to you.
Yeah, it's a great question. It kind of goes at the heart of what the research about. Looking at the artifact, most people are doing that, the scanning and making sure what you're producing is secure, what you're consuming is secure. But we're starting to do more work on is securing the process of how that artifact flows and then gets out the door to your ladder example. So real kind of aha in it for me.
Right. And then it goes to architecture. So I remember when I was at one company, one of the big battles was whether to have your own private repository. And this was back in the middle days of Docker. So are we going to go out to Docker? Are we going to trust that, you know, the images out there are secure, or are we going to say, no, we're never going to do that. We're going to create our own repository. We're going to use images that are only ours. Even if it's a well-known image, we're still going to bring down those Docker files in that source and do it ourselves. And that was a huge fight. That was a huge fight. And that was a fight that actually the company I was at the time got lost. They went right to, they relied upon Docker. So now the question is, and also in saying the sysadmins also is, well, what are the role of these, you know, enterprise level repositories? And I'm seeing that. I mean, honestly, I get caught in when I run an NPM install, I get caught a lot. I get caught a lot. Dude, you got a lot of high vulnerabilities in there. So it's showing up in my work. But the honest, if I'm doing just a demo, I check it in. Mm-hmm. And so now, who's ensured there? You know, Bob did a baddie, right? And so what in the deployment process is one, where's the security check happening? And I defer that to you, Mitch. And the other one is what is the security architecture? Again, local repos, global repos. And you got me. I'm interested to learn.
Yeah, I think that debate is still going on very much, but I think the thing that's shifted is we're not going to just rely on some external repository where it's Docker or it's anything else. Where are we getting that stuff from? And then let's bring that into our own environment and make sure it is what we think it is and that we consistently use that from our repository and flow it that way. Now, is everybody doing that? I don't think it is. So, and I promise I won't call you Rob again.
So
that's cool. Why not?
His name is Robert, but
It is Robert. Yeah. Before a judge. Yes.
Yes.
But to me, not in trouble, so we don't use that name.
To me, here's an issue, though. It's more of a who's watching the watcher issue.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
Right? So we've put in these processors that theoretically, not processors, processes, that theoretically are checking the software that we're getting from repos, whether they be public, private, local, global, whatever. However, we're relying on the software that's checking those artifacts or repo items to, in fact, be themselves not corrupted, right? And who's watching that? Who's checking that? Who's checking the tools we're using on the factory floor to assemble the software, right? And so it's not the classic DevSecOps conundrum of let's throw another straw on the developer's back. It's more of a who's watching the watchers. Can these tools be run self-checks? Do you trust them to run self-checks? You know, should there be an integrity check of the tools as part of your SBOM or something like that to make sure, you know, nothing got introduced after you downloaded it from whatever repo you're using? There's, you know, again, as soon as you solve one bottleneck, we find the next bottleneck. As soon as we solve the problem of scanning software coming from repos, we worry about are the scanners corrupted? And I'm sure once we solve that, there'll be another bottleneck issue we need to hit on. But you know what? That's why this tiger has stripes.
Maybe. Mitch, do you think maybe it's a hollow debate, right? We see it in the industry all the time, but the more I think about it, I'm kind of like, trust nobody. The developer, don't trust them, but there's going to be stuff thrown into the build. Don't trust those people because they can make mistakes as well. And then by the time the whole thing gets deployed in production, somebody's going to do an update anyway. So you got to check it on the far right side of the equation. So maybe we should just be, you know, we throw around the phrase zero trust, but I'm more of the presume everybody's guilty till otherwise proven innocent.
That is zero trust.
Mm-hmm. That is zero trust. Well, you hang around with security people long enough and you know, software folks will become that way as well. I think it's more taking out I personally trust them and I think that's a good source and I'll use that and I'll download my code from there, which you can do on your own or a smaller development team. But it's more formalizing, where are we getting our code? How do we know we're getting it in a way that it's secure? And how do we know that we consistently use that as opposed to something that might have been ingested or added to it? It's almost like, as you were talking down, I was thinking about, it's like the movie Inception. How many layers deep do you have to go to plant that seed, right? That's going to change an outcome. And that's kind of what we're describing is, do I have to go look in every piece of open source software that I deploy in my code? Well, maybe my scanner's doing that, but it's probably not doing all that either. So at some point, you know, there's a diminishing returns, right? We'll never stop scanning.
Yeah. So the other point about it, though, is, you know, philosophically, zero trust sounds great, right? What could be wrong with that? But then it runs headlong, you know, head first right into the wall of, I got to do more faster. And zero, you know, the old saying about your civil rights end at the tip of my nose? Zero trust is fine until it runs into the tip of my I want to go faster debate. And that's what happens is zero trust can wind up slowing things down. And when they do, people scream. When it does, people scream.
I'll throw this out to any one of you three remote folks, but there was a book a long time ago, Ralph Nader wrote it, said Unsafe at Any Speed, describing cars. Are we unsafe at any speed with software development these days?
Well, I think there's always going to be a safety issue, but it just requires constant vigilance and good communication. And maybe, as the article said, some groundwork needs to be put into place and just having a good plan of action for defense.
All right. I think we can end it there. But to Amanda's point, I think the saying goes something like, freedom requires eternal vigilance. Is that where we are?
I've heard that before. It does. You know, I'll also put in that democracy is the worst form or the best of the worst, right? And that's kind of what we've got. All right, we're going to take a break on Tech Strong Gang. We'll be back here in a second.
All right, we are back with our third philosophical argument of the day, and we're talking about this whole push to get everybody back into the office. There's an interview that we did with Jatit Patel, who's over at Cisco. He's one of the senior vice presidents, and he has some things to say about, well, why you may not want to have people come back to the office. Let's run that clip for a second.
The future of work, in my opinion, I very strongly believe in this, is going to be hybrid, where people are going to work in mixed mode. There'll be times that they go into the office, that there'll be times they want to work from home, there'll be times somewhere in the middle. I actually think it would be, Mike, very regressive for society if we required everyone to be back in the office 5 days a week, because what that does is makes geography such a disproportionate prerequisite for economic participation and economic success. So I actually don't think it's a healthy thing to go back to pre-COVID days and everyone work from the office 5 days a week. I think the next generation of leaders need to figure out a way that they can build strong bonds and relationships and serendipity while never having met someone in person.
All right. So he is saying that having everybody move to New York or San Francisco or Chicago, wherever it may be, is bad for society. It's bad for the economy. It reduces the ability to have jobs that they can have well-paying for and live in nice little towns somewhere that would in turn drive their local economy. I know we have talked about the merits of working in the office versus remote. What's your take?
So, I have an opinion or two on this. So keep in mind, myself, and Mitchell knows this, we co-founded Still Secure. I worked remotely for the most part for 10 years, 13 years. Not true. When we first started the company, I actually lived local in the Boulder area for 3 or 4 days a week and then commuted back and forth. I've been through COVID, as we all have. And I'm talking as a CEO now as well. There are layers and layers to this discussion. The first discussion I'm going to answer strictly as a CEO. I don't care what you tell me. Doing this on Zoom is not the same as having Mitchell, Amanda, and Bob sitting around this table with us. There would be more interaction. There would be more productivity. There would be a warmer feeling of togetherness than doing it like this. If I had my druthers, I'd fly them all to Florida and do it here, right? And that is equally as true with people working in office. Yes, there are certain disciplines, certain job functions that it's not maybe quite as important to, but overall, from a societal impact, it works better when people are together. No doubt about it, in the same place. And back to your society point.
You got this finger wagging at me.
I'm sorry. to your society point, I'll take San Francisco as the perfect example, right? San Francisco, in many ways, a ghost town today, because it's not just that people aren't in the office as much, but you need a critical mass of people in the office so that the breakfast restaurant has enough customers to serve breakfast to, so that the lunch places and the bars after work and restaurants have places, so that the dry cleaner can drop people drop their stuff off and do their thing. So that the print shop down the block, and think about all of, and if I want to go retail shopping during my lunch, not on Amazon, I want to feel a shirt, right? You need, I mean, this goes to fundamentally, you know, society. You need critical mass of people. It would be nice if Mitchell was out on some big cloud ranch in Montana and Bob was on some seaside villa in Baja, California, and Amanda's out on St. Pedro Island, and you're up in Galway, Ireland, and I'm sitting here, right? And you all would be really happy. But we wouldn't really, it's hard to do a business like that. Are the tools better? Yeah. But I think they're a pale in comparison of working together.
All right. Any of you remote folks have something to say about this?
Well, I will say, while I see so much value of coming together in person and I hear everything you're saying and do agree to some level, I think what outweighs all of that is comfort of working from home in the environment that you enjoy. You can be in your pajamas if you want to.
That's exactly my point. If you're in your pajamas, go get a different job. I don't want people in their pajamas. I want people dressed for work, because how you dress has a lot to do with how you look at what you're doing. If you're in your pajamas, you're sitting around having fudge brownies.
I beg to disagree. I think the research and the studies are showing that people, when they're working at their comfort level, maybe it's morning, maybe they're morning people, maybe they're night people, and maybe they're midday people.
I need work done when work needs to get done, not when you feel comfortable. My world works on 9 to 5. The fact that you got something done at 10 o'clock, God bless you, but I needed it at 5 o'clock.
Alan, how do you really feel about this?
I'm telling you, I have strong feelings on this subject. I don't need people dressed in their pajamas. I don't dress in my pajamas. Right.
So, let me tell them. Okay, so yes, I admit at one time I'm Bob and I'm a recovering executive. one time in my long and stellar career, I was CTO of a emerging trading company on Wall Street. And I worked in New York during the week, and I went home into the Midwest on the weekends. And I found that my flight day was Monday. And I found myself getting paranoid because I couldn't watch what people were doing. I really couldn't watch what people were doing. What are they doing? They're probably smoking cigarettes and having a party when I'm not there. So I would start, then I changed my schedule to go every other weekend so I could watch them on Monday, right? And so that was more my paranoia. So if they all went remote, I wouldn't know what they're doing anyway, because the paranoia is mine. So going back to your point, Alan, as much as we'd like to have people in front of us, the trend, the heuristic trend I'm seeing is those days are gone. I buy a lot more from Amazon today than I do from Ralph's down the street. As a matter of fact, there are three retailers I go to now. I go to Ralph's down the street to get stuff that's not a Trader Joe's down the street, and then there's a guy that I go to get a haircut. That's it. Everything else is pretty much done online. So the notion, we're all online now, but we're not all online, because the stuff that this remote stuff applies to is knowledge workers. The guy, you know, the 30 construction workers building this building down the street from me, they're not online. And it's interesting, they are remote, because in a sense, their managing office is about 10 miles away. So the point I'm trying to make here is, as much as we'd like to, you know, have people in front of us and enjoy that productivity and that intimacy, yeah, we're all shopping on Amazon now, and that's our future.
So let me run with that a second. I shop on Amazon too, Whole Foods, right? And I have Instacart and all that. Amanda, do you do shopping in person or online?
It's food, a good shopping. Mix of both for me. I'm more of a, I would call it hybrid.
Mike?
I think everybody's mostly a hybrid.
So I will tell you, yes, for packaged goods that you would get on Amazon, but I still, when it comes to supermarket shopping, I like to pick out the specific fruit that I want. This is a good apple. This isn't a good apple. When you order apples from Amazon online, you don't get the good apples. They take whatever the first three apples are and throw them in there. Or the kinds of fish. And I don't necessarily know what they got fresh local in the market that day. So to me, there is no comparison of supermarket shopping in person versus doing that online. And it's the same thing with buying clothes. Yeah, I could buy my clothes online now that I've lost some weight and I can fit into better clothes. But until you touch it, you don't know.
Mitch, is this a technology challenge that we're trying to solve here ultimately? Because theoretically, at least, I could have an algorithm that might tell me how fresh that apple is before it was thrown into a package and shipped to me. Are we just on a journey here and we kind of rushed it because of COVID, but ultimately, you know, there are going to be technology innovations, there's going to be better video, more AI. Are we on just on a path?
Well, I don't know. To me, we're on an evolution of doing more and more online. And the grocery shopping example is a good one of it ain't there yet. The bane of grocery shopping is substitutions. I don't want that brand of peanut butter. That's not what I asked for. And I told you not to substitute. You know, there are still issues to work out with it. You know, that fish doesn't look fresh like what I like to buy. So there are things that aren't there yet, you know, and they're evolving. Maybe they won't get there. In the world that, and I'd be interested in Bob's opinion, the world that Bob and I live in of software creation, you kind of go with where the talent is. And I can't get everybody into Denver, Colorado, or Boca, or LA, or just hire people that are local, because the talent that might be available, the person that's really one on the team is in Austin, you know, come join the team.
Or in Bangkok.
Right. Or Bangkok. Yeah, right. Exactly.
And then we get in, you know, the whole wage compression stuff, which is, you know, another story. What will become interesting if we watch there's two parts here. The evolution of the online experience and this remote work. I'm still of the opinion that remote work is affected, or I'm losing my words here, but it's affected to knowledge workers, and that's only a section of the economy. Everybody else, they're still real time. They're still real time. But if we look at the evolution of the online experience, remember, you know, Amazon started with books, and now if I get a thumb drive that doesn't work, which is a non-perishable commodity, if I get a thumb drive that doesn't work, I just take it down to Whole Foods and I'm credited within, you know,
seconds.
And so my whole shopping experience is no worse than going down to Best Buy, bringing a thumb drive home down the street, putting it in my computer, it doesn't work, and I go back to Best Buy. The reason is that the evolution of the business process is such that it's almost immediate. So going back, so what's the next one? Alan, you're talking about high perishables. So what happens if Amazon says, okay, first of all, we're going to guarantee the quality, and they have, you know, their AI looking, saying, oh no, Alan and Bob and Mitch returned all these apples because they weren't any good. We've got to improve our QA around our fresh produce. And eventually all the apples start showing up cool. Mm-hmm. That's where it'll be going.
All right. So let me take what they're saying and, with all due respect.
You're doing a lot of this today.
basically, Bob and Mitch said, hey, Boomer, to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do you need to learn how to manage in a new world and a new reality? And we can long for the days when we all hung out at a table and there is much to be benefit there, but it's never going to happen.
Yeah. So when it does happen, give me a call. But until then, I'm telling you that people are not as productive working remotely because, and Amanda, I'm not picking on you, I love you, but Amanda hit it right on the head. If she wants to dress in pajamas, say she'll dress in pajamas. If she's having a nighttime work day, she'll work at night. I can't run a business like that. I really can't.
And I think it does come down to if it's project-driven work with deadlines or if it's, you know, truly hourly, you know, you're needed during certain hours. So it depends on the work itself. And like Bob said, it's only a certain type of knowledge work that can be done online.
That works like this. But I'll give you another example to Bob's point about Bangkok. Look, where's the biggest outsource for software development? India, Bangalore. Or other cities in India, Pune and so forth. There's a good chunk of Bangalore that works on North American time. These people get up and they work on our time because that's where their work is. I think that's kind of the way. And I'm not, you guys can make me feel bad all you want. I'm not alone in this. I've got some pretty smart people who are saying the same thing.
Well, we can just say to people, don't put your PJs on from 9 to 5, regardless of where you are, because you are working with people.
To Bob's point, I'm not paranoid where I got to see people to know they're working. I know Amanda works. I see her output. I see how many articles we publish. The point is, how much more productive could she be if she was sitting in the same office as you, right? Because she uses Slack. Part of this remote working thing is you got to use the tools.
These are Slack anti-patterns.
That said, we cannot find people as smart as Mitch and Amanda here in Florida. So
no, we can't.
So
and maybe that's the reason why we shouldn't be in Florida.
Yes, that's what I was going to bring us to the fact that we're casting a wide net.
We don't need
to find
measles
all
vaccines.
The pool of talent.
Yes, you do. And so, look, I think there's a pendulum that swings here, right? Mm-hmm. Even prior to COVID, when we were seeing the boom times in tech, you hired a software coder. If he was in Timbuktu, you would hire him because you need as many software coders as you can get. Now, as we're seeing these layoffs and we're seeing the job market tighten up, now employers are getting a little more picky, saying, I don't want that guy in Timbuktu. Yeah, I want the guy down the block.
You know, Alan, one thing I would say, I do agree. When you're face-to-face, I mean, when we want to like have an important meeting or a whatever working session, we all get together wherever it is, Boca in our case. There's a lot to say to that. I think one of the dynamics we don't talk about is a lot of what you're saying is very true for smaller, medium-sized teams, right? When we're working on projects, we're working on something, we're solving a problem, getting together. When you get into larger organizations, you still tend to hang out in your area. My floor of the building, I don't go to the other floors that often unless I got a meeting up there, and it's not that frequent. I definitely don't go to the other building unless I really have to go. So in larger corporations, the idea of bumping into together and the serendipitous, you know, innovation stuff happens, but not to the same level that it does at smaller teams.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the everybody's got to be in one building is bullshit, because those people are not going to run into each other. They're going to see each other maybe when they walk into the building, and they're going to work with the people that they work with. So, but when you need people to work together on something, the best way is to get him face-to-face. I agree with that.
Fair enough.
It's kind of like when you're texting somebody over and over again and you're continuously going back and forth, texting, and finally you just pick up the phone for a phone call and you get everything taken care of right away. So I think most of the time working remotely is great and everything's spinning along. But then when you just really need a lot of things to come together, being able to meet in person at least once a year, twice a year is so effective.
So, with all due respect to my colleague who calls me a boomer when he's a boomer as well, this is a big issue I have with my kids. Mm-hmm. My kids refuse to pick up a phone and actually talk. Everything is text. Mm-hmm. And again, being remote and texting, you lose a certain intimacy. You lose context. You lose, it's not the same as even talking on a phone, let alone being in person. And are we destined to live in a world of WALL-E where we're all going to be fat blobs sitting on a chair at home, ordering our Amazon, slacking our coworkers, and having AI write our stuff for us? And what's the meaning of life?
Yes, the answer is yes. That is the end state.
That is the future, huh, Mitch?
That doesn't sound too appealing at the end of the day.
Okay.
No, yeah. That does not. At the end of the day, the human element and the relationships are so important.
Save San Francisco.
Back before cars, hay was important because the horses needed them. And so, you know, the point I'm making about that is that the experience will change, and the notion of what it means to be engaged is going to change. The thing I worry about is that we just become so removed from this thing called reality. So, for example, in the old days when you used to get fired, at least you got called into a room. You got called into a room and there are three other people in the room and you had to sign some papers and then you're given your severance check. You know, now you get an email.
Yeah, that's true too.
And what does that mean? Well, what's that? What? And for us, you know, we are, many of us here are boomers. So it's like an amusement to us. Okay, that's cool. Isn't that cute? He just got fired by email. But what happens when that, for a majority of the workforce that does work online, that's their experience of being hired, working, and being fired? What does that do to one's perception of reality?
I don't know, but we saw that poor woman who was fired and she recorded it on video. And I think they, in hindsight, they'd rather have sent an email.
Well, the email is aesthetically clean.
Maybe.
Impersonable,
depending on the content.
Impersonable, because I mean, this is a great point. Look, getting fired is a traumatic experience for anyone, even if you want to get fired, right? And you know, the fact that we do it sort of surgically via an email, or in the case of X Twitter, whatever they call it today, right? They didn't even send the email first. First, they cut you off from all of your email and your, you know, resources and stuff, and then you had to kind of figure out, this means I'm fired, right? That's not human. That's not the kind of company, as a founder of a company, that's not the kind of company I want to run. And unfortunately, we, like everyone else in tech, we've had our share of layoffs, and you know what? It's not a happy thing to do, but it's something, as the CEO, I feel very responsible that I have to do it. It's not my favorite thing for sure, but I do it because the people who we're having to lay off or let go deserve it. Mm-hmm. And that's why, Mike, if you can see
your video game, Alan.
Right. They don't deserve to be laid off. They deserve your attention.
Exactly. They deserve, right. They do. And I feel like it's my responsibility to do that because they deserve better. Mm-hmm. And anyway.
I think there's two things that we should address when it comes to this topic, which is, number one, while the majority love working remotely, and that is the way, and that is the future, we do need to think about the mental health of those who are struggling with working remotely and the isolation. So I think we should talk about that, but also about the technology that does exist and how we harness that technology to make the remote work environment feel as human and close as possible, like removing the distance and making it feel as personal as possible. And there's a lot of technology out there to do those things.
Absolutely. But those are for a future version of Tech, a future episode of Tech Strong Gang. We've gone over our time today. Hey, we hope you enjoyed it. Bob Russellman, I appreciate you getting up so damn early in the morning out there. See, if you didn't work remotely, you'd be right here with us. But thank you very much. We'll have you back on soon. Keep doing what you're doing. Roll Bob cartoons, occasional essays. Bob, just give him a Google if you're interested in seeing some of the great stuff he's doing. Mitchell, Amanda, we'll speak to you soon. Mike, as always, great show. Thank you. All right. This is Alan Schimmel, Mike Vizard, Amanda Rizzini, Mitchell Ashley, and Bob Russellman for Tech Strong Gang. We're out of here.
DevOps.com is the number one online destination for DevOps education and community building. DevOps.com covers all aspects of DevOps, including DevOps best practices and tools, DevOps culture, DevSecOps, business impact, continuous testing, continuous delivery, and more. DevOps.com has the largest collection of original DevOps content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.devops.com to learn more. DevOps.com, where the world meets DevOps.